You're listening to a podcast from the 2014 Norfolk and Norwich Festival, brought to you by Writers' Centre Norwich. This podcast features author Kate Moss delivering the annual Harriet Martineau Lecture at Norwich Playhouse.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome, and it's really good to see so many of you here to help us celebrate the life and work of Harriet Martineau. My name's Helen Wilson, and the only reason I'm standing up here is that I'm a member of the Writers' Centre Board. And it was, of course, the Writers' Centre that was instrumental in gaining the title of UNESCO City of Literature for Norwich. And it was in exploring the extraordinary literary history of this city for the UNESCO bid, the amazing but sadly rather forgotten story of Harriet Martineau's life and her work came to light. So the purpose of these Harriet Martineau lectures is really to write her back into her proper place in our literary heritage, as well, of course, having an extremely nice evening. But what makes this evening a seriously special treat is that Kate Moss has agreed to deliver the second Harriet Martineau lecture. Kate, as you all know, is one of our most successful authors. She's written books, plays, short stories, essays, pieces of journalism. Perhaps some of the most of her best-known work is the trilogy of novels set in the Norfolk. Labyrinth, the first, was a multi-million worldwide bestseller. It's been translated into 30 languages, hit the bestseller list around the world, and was named by Waterstones as one of the top 25 books of the past 25 years. The next two books in the trilogy, Sepulchre and Citadel, both hit the bestseller list around the world again. And if that doesn't make you feel breathless enough, Kate is also the co-founder and now chair of the Women's Prize for Fiction. Originally known as the Orange Prize and now known as the Bailey's Women Prize for Fiction. It celebrates women's writing, campaigns for and supports women's writing around the world, so who better to deliver this year's Harriet Martineau Lecture? See, when Kate's finished her lecture, there'll be a chance for all of you to ask some questions about her books, about Harriet Martineau, about writing, whatever tickles your fancy. I think those of you who perhaps read the festival programme, you'll have seen the word interval underneath tonight's lecture. But actually we decided in the end that an interval wasn't going to work terribly well and sort of inserted between Kate's lecture and the questions that actually be much better once we've heard all Kate's ideas to get on and ask her questions. So, rather differently, we're going to have the interval at the end.
Except for us.
And Kate will also be, as well as answering all your questions, will be there to sign books for you as well at the end. So, enjoy. And Kate, thank you very much for joining us.
Public speaking, which I'm sure you all know, which is if you don't have water, you will cough. If you have it, you won't need it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an enormous pleasure to be here this evening. I think that this festival is quite extraordinary how it's grown and grown. And of course, the Norwich Writers' Centre, who are so much of a powerhouse of writing, but also supporting readers who want to write, as well as writers who are making a living by it. When they invited me to come, I did start by saying, I don't know very much about Harriet Martineau, and you were asking me to speak to an audience who will know a lot, and they said, that is part of the point. So this is a first for me. Those of you who've ever come to any of my book events will know that normally I stand on a stage, I yak on for about 45 minutes, then I sit down again. So I have never given a lecture before, and I have never read a speech in public before. So if it goes terribly badly wrong, then I either turn out not to be able to read at all and my glasses fall off and throw it all away, I hope you will bear with me. But why did I want to come and do this? 10 days away from delivering a new novel. When I start at work every morning at 3, I'm a little bit mad in the way that you are at the end of a novel where you can only think about the thing you're writing about. And the reason is, of course, because Harriet Martineau was a great woman and a great person. And so the idea to learn more about her, someone like me, if you like, who should have known more about her than I did, seemed like one of those moments to honour the past and to honour all of those people that have gone before. And so that's why I'm standing here this evening, and I suspect why many of you are here this evening. So, of course, Martineau was, as everyone here knows, a 19th century radical and the world's first female retained journalist. She was a progressive thinker and a best-selling writer who spent her life championing economic fairness, racial equality, women's rights, the abolition of slavery, secularism in thought, and the struggle for a more just society. She overcame physical disability and illness. Many of her contemporaries considered her a phenomenon. She was famous and celebrated in her time. Tireless. Someone who, looking at her extraordinary achievements, deserves to be a household name. Which is one of the reasons I'm here, taking part in what is only the second of a series of lectures and debates, conceived both as a celebration of the life of a remarkable woman, her many writings, her political, social, and academic impact, and as a way to honour her legacy. Now, my brief, an interesting but broad one, was to reflect on Martineau, a woman writing in the 19th century, through the lens of my own experience as a woman writing in the 21st century. So in that spirit, tonight's lecture is as much a thinking aloud, shall we say, as a call to arms. I am, as I said, a Martineau novice, a new disciple, at the beginning of learning and thinking about this extraordinary woman. And in that same spirit of reflection, I constructed my thoughts around four main interconnected areas to give us food for thought for our conversation later. First, and they're not necessarily in the order that they're going to come, Martineau herself and the progressive free-thinking tradition she sprang from. Second, the importance as writers of acknowledging those writers who have gone before us and making sure their names are and remain known. You will hear the names of many other women writers, many male writers too, making an appearance tonight for that reason. Third, how the excavation of untold or forgotten histories, in particular that of women in light of being here to honour Harriet Martineau, is essential to any accurate and purposeful analysis of history. Fourth, how place and character are fundamentally linked. And underscoring all of this, I suppose, is my belief that fiction can be as powerful and persuasive a tool by which to change opinion, by which to convey ideas of worth and to honour those who have gone before, as non-fiction. Many of us, not least of all Harriet Martineau herself, do both. So in her wonderful inaugural Harriet Martineau lecture last year, which you can listen to online, Ali Smith said this: "Everything, sooner or later, transforms into story." So that's where I'm going to start, with story. Martineau, not to forget, wrote children's stories, novels, travelogues, as well as her brilliant social and economic pamphlets and essays. Now, writers are often asked how we start a new novel, a version of where do your ideas come from? And I always reply, and honestly so, that the stories that I write come from the land beneath my feet, to slightly paraphrase Willa Cather. History and place are, for me, the twin pillars of fiction. And as a novelist, my task is to put on the page the emotional realities of imagined characters and come up with an exciting plot, but against the backdrop of real, verifiable history. Now, novelists of historical fiction have always found ways of slipping between the cracks of the recorded facts so as to shine a spotlight on overlooked histories. Stella Duffy's Theodora, Amanda Scott's Boudicca novels, Philippa Gregory's Berlin Girls. And I too have form in this regard. In 1989, my husband Greg and I bought a tiny house in the shadow of the medieval city walls of Carcassonne, in a region of the southwest of France called Languedoc. Coup de foudre, I fell in love immediately with the blue midi sky and the mountains of the Pyrenees and the endless fields of vines and red-tiled roofs. And I fell in love, too, with the complex from troubled history. I learned, for example, in Carcassonne in 1200, a Cathar woman had full rights of inheritance, had control of her dowry after marriage, and could divorce without loss of status. These so-called heretical Christians, the Cathars, had female as well as male priests. So, as well as falling in love with the landscape, I fell in love with the history, and those two things together brought forth a dream, if you like, of a sequence of novels that would tell the untold stories of women of that region and hidden stories of war and the consequences of war, faith and the consequences of faith. Adventure stories, like my father used to read me, but ones that put women centre stage, the hero of their own stories, rather than the heroine, which for me always carries with it the sense of the supporting character. In other words, actually, novels reflecting the world as it was and as it is. I was lucky. When I began research in earnest for the novel that would become Labyrinth, it coincided with a mighty effort of detailed historical work, academic work, for the most part taking place in Toulouse. There, an archive of inquisitional registers were kept under controlled conditions, and documents 700 and 800 years old were dictations taken by scribes working for the inquisitors, delegated by the Pope in Rome to extirpate an entire community. The Cathars believed in what they called the Book, the Gospel according to John. They revered the Holy Spirit. They believed all women, as well as all men, capable of what they called perfection. Their priests were known in medieval Latin as perfects or perfected ones. The Inquisition condemned them as heretics, condemned them to burn. So how did this Cathar knowledge, these written words, survive the genocide? Well, ironically, it was the Stasi-esque attention to detail of the Inquisition, the verbatim testimony collected by, in Kipling's phrase, these stark enthusiasts, has endured, written in inks on animal skins, bound between timber boards, rolled and preserved, tied with fragments of ribbon. And as the inquisitors asked the same questions over and again, they inadvertently created an astonishing complex life in medieval Carcassonne and Toulouse, in the mountains of the Pyrenees, in the plains of the Lauragais. And what does this mean? These non-fiction testaments of faith, a faith that was under attack, can be read years later by people such as a novelist who decides to write that story in a different sort of form from the form it was originally written down in. But the stories are the same, and the echoes of those people through the 700, 800 years since the Cathar genocide can be heard in different ways in non-fiction, fiction, poetry, the troubadour songs. For centuries, the Cathar language, the Occitan, it remained lost, firstly in Latin, and then obviously from the Occitan was very unknown. And it emerged really only because, again, another type of writer, another type of architect, excavator, if you like, led in this case by the astonishing Jean Duvenoir and René Nelly, spent their days transcribing and translating the medieval Latin into modern French and Occitan and correcting the misunderstandings. More recently, Anne Brennan too. All of them, all of us, in our different ways, bringing to light untold stories. And for me, standing here giving the Harriet Martineau lecture, the beginning of excavating Harriet Martineau for me was the same process of shining a light on a story that I didn't know. And I don't know if Stuart Hobday is here this evening. Is he here? Are you here anywhere, Stuart? He is there. I would just like to say, in the tribute of one writer to another, I couldn't have got under the skin of Harriet Martineau so quickly were it not for the work of a fellow writer, Stuart Hobday, who has been very generous in sharing his words with me. So, Stuart, thank you very much. And I think Harriet Martineau would have understood the work of Brennan or Duvenoir, because she too sought truths that the powerful find uncomfortable. inimical to their power. Martineau knew that words matter, that writing things down matters, because it is sometimes the only way to ensure that ideas, that truths, can survive, to speak beyond time and context. And just because I'm a writer of fiction doesn't mean that I don't think that accuracy is just as important as any historian might do. For Labyrinth, I felt the need to research everything. What my medieval characters would eat, how would they prepare their food, as much as the date on which this battle began or that edict was delivered. Because without that bedrock of fact, why would my readers have confidence in my fictional world? For the second of the Languedoc trilogy, Sepulchre, I felt it was essential to know, given restrictions of fin de siècle clothing for women, if my woman hero, caught up in an anti-Wagner riot at the Palais Garnier in Paris 1896, would be able to run in her corsets and her high-buttoned boots. So yes, there are always gaps, and this is where the novelist's imagination can take root. And allied to this, as a writer of novels that puts women at the heart of the stories, it is a great benefit, if you will, that women's lives have often been poorly documented, or only partially documented, sometimes disregarded and allowed to disappear from the record. In February, the Cambridge Classics professor, Mary Beard, delivered a lecture for the London Review of Books. It was called On the Public Voice of Women, Language and Misogyny, laying bare the ways in which women throughout history had struggled to be heard. She started with Telemachus, son of Penelope and Odysseus, in Homer's Odyssey. I want to start very near the beginning of the tradition of Western literature, Professor Beard said, and its first recorded example of a man telling a woman to shut up, telling her that her voice was not to be heard in public. Mother, he says, go back up to your quarters and take up your own work, the loom and the distaff. Speech will be the business of men, all men, and of me most of all, for mine is the power in this household. Now for me, the fact that Professor Beard was delivering such a lecture and to a packed audience at the British Museum perhaps is a sign that things are changing and that there is a new determination to put women's experience and voice at the heart of the debate. Perhaps. Though I can't help wondering if Harriet Martineau might have been surprised at still how far there is to go before women's stories and those of the unpowerful are considered fundamental to the narrative of history. It's true to say, also, that over the past 20 years odd, there is evidence that historians and political scientists have been determined to put women's experiences at the heart of their work, from Anthony Beaver's searing descriptions of rape as a weapon of war in Berlin, to the biographical histories of authors such as Rachel Holmes, Bettany Hughes, or Amanda Foreman. And isn't that what Harriet Martineau would have wanted, with her extraordinary curiosity and genius for analysis and sympathetic understanding? The shabby old cliché of history being written by the victors, an aphorism commonly misattributed to originating with Winston Churchill, has had its day. Readers in the 21st century, as Martineau did long time before us, want a plurality of voices, want the widest experience of all ethnicities, all faiths and abilities, all civilizations properly and appropriately included. As a journalist of energy and renown, Martineau employed a sceptical critical intelligence. And how much today might we benefit for her passion for change, her unstinting resolve to see and describe what she saw. She received a letter saying that Currer Bell wished to visit her. The letter precipitated great excitement in the home, in part focused on whether the author of Jane Eyre would turn out to be a man or a woman. Rather brilliantly, I think, Martineau was convinced that the knowledge of textiles demonstrated in the novel could only be that of a woman, or a tailor. Like Charlotte Bronte as Currer Bell, Harriet Martineau published nearly all of her journalism under male pseudonyms or anonymously. I don't believe that this was a problem to do with confidence. It seems to me that Martineau was, once she had made up her mind, sure of herself. Not the cocksure certainty that we see in people who exhibit confidence as a screen for doubt, but the solid strength of mind that comes from having thought things through and reached one's own considered conclusion. But that doesn't mean she was impervious to argument, not at all. How wonderful, I think, that this strong-minded woman, someone whose intellect and sympathy provided her with a progressive mental framework, and one that society would take many years to catch up with, chose Discipulus as a pseudonym. Discipulus. Student, not teacher. Disciple, not prophet. But I wish we knew more of her thought. It is a literary tragedy, a social tragedy, that many writings published anonymously escape our grasp. And in 2014, women who publish in this country, at least, do not have to resort to subterfuge of ungendered initials, although they can. And why? Well, of course, it is thanks to those who have gone before us. This is what Virginia Woolf outlined in a speech to a branch of the National Society for Women's Service in January 1931. She said this: "The road was cut many years ago by Fanny Burney, by Aphra Behn, by Harriet Martineau, by Jane Austen, by George Eliot, many famous women, and many more unknown and forgotten have been before me, making the path smooth and regulating my steps. As when I came to write, there were very few material obstacles in my way." Now, no one here this evening needs me to explain the importance of Jane Austen or George Eliot, known socially to Harriet Martineau, of course, as Marianne Evans. And how interesting it would have been, wouldn't it, to have heard their conversations. I can imagine Martineau explaining energetically her opposition to creationism or her support for social reform. And could aspects of Martineau's vigorous common sense or idealism have made their way into the characters of Dorothea or Lydgate in Middlemarch? You go back to the novel and wonder. It's not maybe widely known that the voracious reader and critic Henry Crabb Robinson made his own wonderfully trenchant judgment of his contemporaries, Harriet Martineau and Jane Austen. "I was reading today," he wrote, "and I've since finished Miss Martineau's Dear Book, a capital novel, though it is too full of preaching. It is inferior in execution to Miss Austen's novels in the development of common characters, but it is superior in the higher parts." I really feel grateful that we don't have reviewers like that today, that's all I can say. And I wonder, though, if Aphra Behn and Fanny Burney are also, to use the terminology of mastermind, specialist subjects rather than general knowledge too. They should not be either, because what lives they led. I'm going to return to fiction and writing now, and why I think that fiction still has the power to persuade and move sometimes when a pamphlet or a piece of journalism or non-fiction doesn't. Because a novelist needs more than just the past. The novelist needs knowledge and a reason to bring it back to life, a special time and place, a character, a struggle, a way of life lost. And the novelist, as I said, needs gaps in that knowledge too. There must be something that we can invent that will fit almost imperceptibly into the panorama of history. Think of it as a jigsaw with a few pieces missing, and the novelist making some replacement pieces carefully at an infinite cost of time and effort, and they are not the original pieces, but they do fit all the same. Perhaps the join can just be seen. Perhaps it doesn't matter. 7 or 8 years after Labyrinth was published, I was researching for the third in the Languedoc trilogy, Citadel, which is the story of an all-female resistance unit operating in Carcassonne under the Nazi occupation of 1942 to 1944. Our research is seductive, and there comes a moment with every novel when you realise you are drowning or being too indulgent, maybe. And again, the fact I was able to move the novel forward was thanks to the work of other women and other men who had refused to allow the dominant narrative of history to prevail and who had taken time to excavate the less well-known stories in France during the Second World War. And I read some wonderful, though harrowing, accounts of active female involvement in the resistance. The memories of Lucy Obrach and Lisa Fitko, Alice Resch-Sinstadt and Genevieve de Gaulle-Ambroise. But as is the way of these things, the more I learned, the more questions I had. What about the Spanish communist fighters in the resistance and the anarchists who fled Franco's victory? What about the Jewish resistance and the German anti-fascists and the Dutch Quakers? Why were they all missing from the dominant narrative of the occupation of France in the Second World War? the histories of the Années Noires. And of course, where were the women? At the end of World War II, some 1,100 gold Croix de Guerre medals were presented by General de Gaulle for exceptional conduct, the ones at the absolute top level. 11 were given to villages or towns en masse who resisted as a community. Fewer still, possibly 8 or 9, accounts differ, and it's hard to pin down the actual figure, but 8 or 9 were given to women. Now, part of the problem is that while men had first and second name code names, women only had, as they called it, a Christian name. And many, it is true, did not want to be remembered or remember. Even so, I know from reading and talking to our friends in Carcassonne and their parents and grandparents, more women in Carcassonne alone than those 8 who received gold Croix de Guerre. Women who carried messages on their bicycles with cork and rubber soles on their shoes, who walked the same country pathways as the Cathar Perfects had before them, greeting the upcountry guerrilla resistance of the Maquis with passwords whispered in the night. In November 1943, a group of Carcassonne schoolgirls staged a protest at the fact that their Jewish friends were no longer allowed to sit in school with them. Women shared their ration coupons with neighbours compelled to live in hiding. Women planted bombs and derailed trains and were arrested and questioned, executed and released, assaulted, punished. But their cause was finally triumphant. Some would have it that women were less likely to be politically motivated by the men into joining the resistance, and that way will be true. Though intractably opposed to Nazi philosophy and the occupation, they were likely in many cases to be fighting to save their friends and their neighbours and their families, because it was wrong not to do so. And when the war was over, some wanted to celebrate and then forget the Années Noires. They did not want their names on memorials or to be honoured for their courage. Or maybe they did. There is a monument that inspired Citadel, and it's a story that I think would have appealed to Harriet Martineau's amazing journalistic instincts and to her committed humanitarianism. It might also appeal to her novelistic sense of the dramatic and the tragic, because it happened on the eve of the Nazi withdrawal from Carcassonne. The resistance in Carcassonne was young, because the occupation only began there in 1942. But during the course of July and August 1944, the whole of the Carcassonne resistance was caught and rounded up and taken to the prison in Carcassonne. And for reasons that we still don't know, on the morning of the 19th of August 1944, the Wehrmacht and the SS and the collaborationist French police, the militia, arrived and took the captives away. They took them to a place called the Château de Baudrigue outside of Carcassonne, a place, a beautiful house, wouldn't have been out of place in Norwich, I think, and it would have been used as a munitions store. And there they had hand grenades put in their mouths, and they were blown up so that they could not be identified. It's an act of quite extraordinary spite that makes no sense, of course, because it is quicker to shoot somebody. But even more poignant, if you will, is the fact that the Nazi occupation withdrew that night. So for the want of a few hours, those daughters and sons, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, friends, would have survived. And they would have been in the pictures that we have of the resistance and the Maquis coming down from the hills in Carcassonne on the 20th. Of August. But they didn't. Over the years, most of the people who died that day have been identified. Muriel, the codename of the leader of the resistance, Jean Bringer, Amy Raymond, the deputy leader, who was a serving police officer. And there are 3 tombstones in the beautiful parkland of Baudry where they died now. One to Jean Bringer, one to Amy Raymond, and the 3rd listing all the names of the other men who died that day. The bottom of that monument is the line that inspired Citadel. It is the reason that I wanted to come and honour Harriet Martineau here in Norwich. And it simply says this: and 2 unknown women. Now, I don't know who those women were, and I suspect we never will know who those women were. But I know the sort of women that they must have been, and the sort of men and women who must have loved them for them to have achieved what they did. We can't write the history of those 2 women, but we can write a novel that honours those sort of women. Because history is and should be the story of us all, even if it makes for a messier, less linear history. And individual stories mustn't be lost for the sake of a clearer or bigger picture. And thinking about women and men together, sharing new ideas and aims, I want to recount another story from Martineau's life, this time concerning her odd relationship with the ideas and person of Charles Darwin. Of course, it's important to know that Darwin's brother Erasmus was in love with Harriet. And Charles wrote, "She was very agreeable and managed to talk on a most wonderful number of subjects, considering the limited time. I was astonished to find how little ugly she is. But as it appears to me, she is overwhelmed with her own projects, her own thoughts, and her own abilities." Erasmus palliated by all of this by maintaining one ought not to look at her as a woman. Can this be right? Can Harriet not be thought of as a woman? It's interesting, isn't it, that even Darwin's questing intelligence could not see beyond the blinkers society equipped him with, that Harriet Martineau was, independent of gender, a seeker after truth. She knew that action based on partial or misleading information is doomed. And with tongue-in-cheek, she wrote of her own life in her preemptive autobiographical obituary. Her original power was nothing more than was due to earnestness and intellectual clearness within a certain range. With small imaginative and suggestive powers, and therefore nothing approaching to genius, she could see clearly what she did see and give a clear expression to what she had to say. Modest for someone so extraordinary. And if Harriet Martineau would have honoured the forgotten or disregarded of the medieval period or World War II, her life was also a similar celebration of place. Martineau was nurtured by her town, this town, the remarkable, beautiful capital of Norfolk, UNESCO World City of Literature, Nonconformist Norwich. Way back in 1194, as the Pope in Rome plotted the downfall of the Cathars, Richard Coeur de Lion granted a charter permitting all of Norwich's assemblies and courts to be led by men of the inhabitants' own choosing. Is there something in the air? Walking through Norwich today, past the extraordinary and impressive civic architecture of its noble past, can we connect the same wellsprings that nourished Martineau's free thinking? As all of you will know, Harriet was born in Gurney Court off Magdalen Street, Norwich. And those of you lucky enough to have heard Ali Smith's lecture last year will already know that this address was in 1802, also the birthplace of Elizabeth Fry. What I didn't know until I booked here today was that there was this association with the extraordinary First World War hero, Edith Cavell, the woman who I chose my portrait for the National Portrait Gallery. The one picture that should be kept permanently on the walls was Edith Cavell. And the picture is of her in a garden here with two little terriers at her feet, and I'm sure most of you will know it. Now, Martineau, as Fry, was shaped by the nonconformist, I love that phrase, Unitarian sect around the Octagon Chapel. The library at the Forum has many copies of Martineau's works and has recently catalogued a large microfilm collection of her letters and writings. The Forum's blog is subtitled, and I love this too, "Where the Past Meets the Future," a thought that surely chimes with the justified civic pride of this city and also with me as a writer of historical fiction grounded in fact, grounded in place. Is it fanciful to suggest that Martineau's ideas and city of birth were inextricably linked? That she could, in part, think and write and live as she did because she grew up here in Norwich? I don't think it is. People, places, stories lead one from the other. In fiction, stories come out of landscape and environment as surely as they come from an idea or character. And despite years of neglect, Martineau's progressive thinking can be detected all around the globe. To again quote Stuart Hobday, "She spent her life championing economic fairness, racial equality, women's rights, the abolition of slavery, secularism in thought, and the struggle for a more just society." As I said right at the beginning. And that's a life well lived, isn't it? As a writer of fiction, I was also delighted to discover from Stuart's writing that she wrote economic parables, histories, novels, children's stories, and travelogues. And why, I wondered, would that be? Why would someone as acute, as clever, as clear-sighted as Harriet Martineau want to count her ideas in fiction? What is the benefit of crafting a web of lies? For that's what fiction is, let's not forget, in order to make a political point. Because sometimes, of course, the words tell you how they need to be written. They tell you the form in which they might be best heard. And if your mission, as I believe Harriet Martineau's was, is to get ideas out there and to help people to listen and to think and talk to each other about ideas, it would always be the vehicle mattered less than the stories and the ideas that were being used. 8 years before Darwin and Wallace announced their natural selection to the world, though, Martineau published her own evolutionary text in 1851, entitled Laws of Man's Nature and Development. It was presented as a series of letters between her and Harriet Atkinson, and it placed mankind, I use her word, firmly among the animals, situated the human mind within nature, and lampooned simplistic religious thought. It was widely condemned, and some have suggested that the hostile reception given to Martineau's work contributed to Darwin's initial hesitancy to publish. Is there an advantage, therefore, to be found in fiction through which the dangerous ideas can be smuggled out into the open, almost without fanfare? Now, all writers, fiction, non-fiction, poets, playwrights, biographers, know this strange double life, the simultaneous preoccupation with fact and with fiction, truth and lies. When I am not cloistered at my computer and my view of the copper beech and chestnut trees for my study window, with my ghosts and my armies and my women of history and rocks and trees and caves, I'll be thinking about other people's writing. I will be thinking about the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction. And for 19 years now, we have worked to promote new novels to the widest possible audience. Like Martineau, we promote our cause, as it were, in the newspapers, although these days it's called marketing. We address meetings, but these days we call it events. And at some point during the prize year, someone will ask me, do we still need a women's prize? And I will smile, and I'll say, need? Do we need? And then I'll suggest, and not for the first time, that even if there were no need, even if there were a level playing field for the honouring of women's writing, past and present, if review space and bylines apportioned were equal, and they're not, by the way, we should always look to celebrate the very best in writing by women from all over the world. Celebrate. Nothing to do with need. That a prize that honours and promotes, puts international fiction into the hands of male and female readers who appreciate it, is worthwhile. That it is following, if you will, in the tradition of Harriet Martineau and all those women who went before and after her. And that there should be no need to apologise for being successful in promoting excellent fiction, some of which might otherwise have slipped away into silence. Celebrating words, ideas, writing is more than ever worthwhile. And we know from someone as extraordinary as Harriet Martineau, when someone like her can find that her reputation is not at the forefront of every library, of every discussion. We know how easy it is for things that matter to slip away. Every year since 2009, the organisation VIDA, an American organisation, Women in the Literary Arts, has released an annual count, for example, documenting the gaping divide, sometimes, between the number of men and women being published in literary magazines, journals and book reviews. At The Atlantic, the London Review of Books, New Republic, The Nation, and The New Yorker, fewer than a quarter of its bylines are by women. At the New York Review of Books, for the fourth year in a row, the figure was fewer than 20%. But these numbers are not inevitable. Things can be changed. In 2012, the Paris Review, 70 men and 18 women. In 2013, the numbers had shifted 48 men and 47 women. So félicitations to the Paris Review, I say. And in 2013, the New York Times Book Review had 412 male and 393 female and one transgender. And the uptick is also present in the books reviewed. In 2012, 237 books reviewed were written by women versus 488 by men. In 2013, only a year later, 327 were written by women and 400 by men. Progress and progressive ideas can easily stall, and we must never stop organising in their favour. But people now, as Martin and then, who draw attention and speak out, are the vehicles through which change happens and takes root. And of course, all of this campaigning brings me back to Harriet Martineau, and perhaps the reason her profile rightly continues to rise. As Stuart Hobday says, in her later life, she instigated a formidable partnership with Florence Nightingale to campaign for better hospitals, and her persistent pro-North, pro-Lincoln journalistic coverage of the American Civil War made her an internationally celebrated campaigner. And I think it's fair to say that we are indebted to historians and researchers in the USA for giving us what we might call a sort of Harriet Martineau studies, a bit of a shot in the arm. And of course it happened because in 1835, Harriet toured America in order to judge for herself how the new young country was measuring up to its constitutional ideals. It's important to remember that the American War of Independence in 1776 was an event that occurred within her father's lifetime. The tour took her to the southern states, where she saw slavery at first hand. Later, she spoke at a meeting of the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society, leading to more protests and threats on her life. Back in England, she published, again using Stuart Hobday's words, the groundbreaking polemic Society in America, whose strident abolitionist theme received vitriolic reviews in America. But she did it. A final thought, and this is one that is instinct only. I think maybe that Harriet Martineau was inspired in part by a desire to heal what was broken. She did not go to the new American Republic to carp and criticise, but to engage in constructive debate. I think she might have followed Cicero's dictum, criticised by creation, not by finding fault. And if we look resolutely forward with optimism and determination, we aren't always focused on past mistakes. But it is true, is it not, that we cannot heal the present without first understanding and then digesting the past. So still today, we need the Everyday Sexism Project to remind us that these things are mundane sometimes and all around us and routine. We need new and inspiring Martineau voices to make themselves heard in the cause of what we know is right, that we are all human beings with inalienable dignities and rights. And by remaining curious, with judgment and intelligence, we can, like Martineau, continue to promote ideas of justice, equality, and an optimistic faith in the improvability, if not the perfectibility, of human society. And we can't know, of course, what Martineau would say, think of the things that occupy us now. And it is dangerous for anybody to co-opt somebody from the past and imagine themselves entirely in their shoes. But do you not think we can guess what she might have to say about the continuing visible existence of the sexual enslavement of girls and boys, men and women, or the attacks on the rights of girls and women to go to school and be taught to read, let alone write? And you can bet she would have been one of the first to take to Twitter to retweet hashtag bring back our girls. And when I was writing this 4 weeks ago, I hoped that that wouldn't need to stay in. Against big business she would be campaigning and dangerous working conditions that holds life cheap. Would she perhaps have supported the Occupy campaign? I'm sure she'd be campaigning against the reversal of rights all over the world and possibly waving a flag at the opening ceremony of the Paralympics. I'm sure today she would have been retweeting the tweet from Liberty, from Stephen Fry, from Eddie Izzard, from many women and men up and down the country saying, do not forget to vote because people died so all of us could vote. Because the thing about Martineau, in the short amount of time that I've been thinking about her and learning about her from writers who have gone before me, the one thing I feel we can know is that she was brave and she was courageous. And she spoke out and she wrote out. So I'm going to finish, really, where I started, with Addie Smith. Last year, she gave a brilliant and very strongly biographical tour de force about Harriet Martineau, which is why today I was asked to talk about being a writer rather than talk about being a biographer. But she finished her fabulous lecture last year, quoting the anchorist Julian of Norwich. Written in the late 14th century, her Revelations of Divine Love, which is now mostly known as the short text, is said to be the oldest surviving book written by a woman in English. And I also rather like the fact that the English mystic Marjorie Kemp is credited to being the author of the first ever autobiography written in England. And she mentions coming to Norwich in 1414 to speak and meet Julian of Norwich, a double first for Norwich, so to speak. And these are beautiful lines, and you know them well, and they are often quoted, but they always bear listening to again. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. And it is a rightful optimism, and I believe and hope it may be true. We grow out of our lands, we grow out of our pasts. Even if progress is not inevitable, even if setbacks come, I am convinced that the spirit of optimism, inspired and embodied by the extraordinary person Harriet Martineau, lives on. That and the determination to make tomorrow a little fairer than today, so that the lessons of the past inspire the successes of the future. So Harriet Martineau, we are all in your debt, and may there be many, many, many Harriet Martineaus, and many Harry Martineaus as well, to come following in your footsteps. Thank you very much. Stumbly, but Now, this, can I just say, I know this gives a terrible impression, but because I'm writing a novel at the moment, I'm afraid I get up at 3. So I've been up for a long time, so this is a nightcap. And if you want me to stay awake for the questions, I need to have a slug of wine. So
Kate's really obvious. I haven't, but Kate's really full of bursting with ideas and a bit of a call to arms as well. So thank you very much. I just wanted to start on one of the points you made about trying to excavate a bit of the untold stories, and particularly women's stories, to give us a different view on history. And I know in lots of your novels, there are very feisty, quite strong-willed young women who are in the lead, and often in situations where you'd expect them to be men in a way, in battle zones and in wars, then you have very strong young women fighting for a cause, fighting for justice. Is that a very conscious decision on your part when you start envisaging these stories, that that's the way they'll be told, or is it just an inevitable thing that that's the way you tell
because that's not you? Well, it's probably because I'm a woman, and I don't think it's surprising that therefore I would write women, although I love writing male characters just as much, actually. But no, it is precisely what I was trying to pick out here in the spirit of Harriet Martineau's legacy. She was a quite extraordinary person, and there were other people who were extraordinary too. But yet somehow, they are not household names. And the minute you start to research into a period of history, you discover that in every period of history, there have been women and men standing together. But yet, a narrative often suggests that there are a lot of men here, and there's a woman with a nice dress standing in the corner, waiting to be, and I said to my lovely dad, who sadly died 3 years ago, when I was writing Labyrinth, I said to him, "Daddy, I'm writing the sort of novels that you used to read me," because he used to read me my bedtime stories, and I had two younger sisters, and he was a chap of a certain age, he fought in the Second World War, and he read me the stories he'd liked as a child. So at 5 years old, he was reading me King Solomon's Mines, utterly inappropriate things, because that's what he'd read. And I said, I'm writing the same sort of novel that you used to read me, Daddy, except there's a twist. There are old-fashioned adventure stories, clear moral landscape, goodies versus badlies, but the difference is that the women are the heroes for once. So rather than standing on a hillside waiting to be rescued, the women are the ones with the swords doing the rescue. He looked at me and he said, "Darling, I've waited all of my life for a woman with a sword to come and rescue me." But so, I mean, that's a joking answer, but it's that. So that the minute you are in a new place, you realise that there are so many stories that have never been at the heart of fiction. So why would you retread old ground? And I think, you know, the same reason, it's why I don't write love stories. You know, I love that, you know, the quote with Jane Austen. You see, for me, that's not interesting to me, writing about falling in love and marrying. I want to write about everything else about a woman's life. And I'd like men to write about men falling in love and marrying. So if you like, the emotional landscape of men is often ignored, and the physical and active landscape of women is often ignored. And as a novelist, as opposed to historian, you can go into those gaps and animate the realities of history, even when the facts leave you with a slight gap to jump over. Mm.
And you talked about the importance of remembering writers and keeping their ideas alive, and particularly some of the lesser known authors. Is that simply because it enriches all our lives, or does it go deeper than that, the need that we remember these ideas that were written at a different time?
I think it goes deeper. I think that, you know, the old sort of athlete, credit where credit's due, you know, I believe in that. I think that people should be honoured for their achievements, and they shouldn't be attributed to somebody else, because we all achieve different things at different times. And I think that we all make up the community, the tapestry, whatever terrible phrase that, you know, you pull out of the top of your head. But I also think that ideas in terms of being put into action are complex, and that by stripping them down to simplicities, to very much this is right and this is wrong, and leaving out the nuances that might have informed something, is often why we don't learn. We don't do things a better way the second time around. And I think that's what's so interesting about Harriet Martineau's passion against slavery. She went and saw it there, firsthand, in the South, and then thought, no. Now, we know the reasons why slavery kept going, that there are vested interests. The minute you start to have the debate saying, but there are vested interests, this is why it didn't finish, not because it was morally right, then suddenly you go, aha. So it's that being informed gives the ideas heft and weight, and we are more likely to make decisions that will, you know, I'm still old-fashioned. I think we should be every day thinking, can we make the world a bit better than it is? I don't think that is the wrong way to see things. Mm-hmm. And I think complexity of ideas is part of that.
I just want to ask you one question about the prize, and then we'll open it up. When I used to work for Radio 4, we were always asked, why do you still have a programme called Women's Hour? It seems desperately hard still, doesn't it? I mean, some of the numbers you read out just now about the inequality of work that's published. Why is it so difficult to get ourselves to a situation where there is great equality?
Because there aren't enough people like Martineau who speak out, would be one of the answers to that. Most people, and I'm aware we're doing this in the backdrop of a media campaign for an election today, and, you know, so a lot of these things are buzzing around. Most people do not consciously set out to be unfair to somebody else. Some people do, we know this. But most people, most of us, are bumbling along trying to do our best. And therefore, it is often very difficult to accept that there might be systemic problems that simply stop everybody with this particular ethnic background or this particular disability or from getting a fair crack at the whip. In the last 20 years, I would say that a philosophy of individualism has meant that many, many people, even if they don't really believe this, particularly I think you see it with younger people, do seriously think that if they don't make it, it is their fault. So when you look to another country, you can see inequalities, but you can't necessarily see it here. I I would describe, you know, I mean, I think that men and women working together is best. I think that's how the world works best. And when you start to therefore look at the figures, you see that what persists is the sense of there being such a thing as a neutral voice, and that everybody who is not part of that dominant voice is therefore secondary to it. And ironically, women, even though they're in some places a majority, are part of that not status quo. And one of the things that I'm so proud about with the prize is that what we're doing, apart from celebrating, apart from bringing international writing very much centre stage as well, and not British and Commonwealth, which of course many writers in the world find that a very offensive way of organising literature, obviously. But what we are also doing at the same time is not standing on barricades shouting at people that they're all terrible. What we're doing is standing on the barricades waving a flag saying there is a much bigger canon of extraordinary novels than you might know. And let's make that, let's extend the canon. I have changing thoughts on quotas on this point. For us, we set up the prize under our own terms to celebrate outstanding writing by women. We did not go and say all prizes must have an equal quota of men and women, because that is clearly ludicrous. I think great art is above gender, but I don't think the marketing, promoting, selling numbers of bylines is. And there's a way to go. In books, it's a lot better than almost any other art form. And that's joyous because reading is probably the most democratic of art forms. But in America and the UK, still only 3% of works on permanent display in art galleries are by women. 3%. So you need Martineau. That's the point. This is why her legacy is so important. It's not just about saying, wasn't she wonderful? And there should be another statue or another this, that, and the other. It's about saying that without people who draw attention to inequalities, nothing changes. They never just change on their own.
I'm not going to hog you anymore. We're going to throw it open. Could we just sort the light? That's lovely, so I can see. Thank you very much. So it's your turn, guys. If you put up your hands to ask questions. We're recording this, so we need to be able to hear the questions, and it may be that we need to repeat them anyway. So we will repeat the questions before Kate answers. And we'll try and make that not too prolonged. So, who would like to start us off?
They're all disappointed because they thought they were going to get an interval to go to the bar. Now they can see our wine and we're too embarrassed.
And you're welcome to ask about Harriet Martineau, about your books, about Kate's books, about writing, whatever catches your fancy. So, yes.
You've been speaking a lot about male authors having good on. Now, I know this evening's lecture is about the woman, but if we look around, the number of men here is rather small. And it seems to me that right readers of fiction are predominantly women. Women are the people who go to book clubs. And it's very interesting that the men are doing the writing and the women are doing the reading. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, hopefully without getting...
Do you want to hear that?
I'm definitely going to have a slow
Really, it's just about the dichotomy of the fact that it is... Really, men do most of the writing, and yet it is predominantly women who read fiction or consume fiction.
I think there are several reasons for this. With the prize, we have invested an enormous amount of money into research into reader gender and writing, because when I was setting the prize up, it became clear that there was no research, so it was all sort of, you know, suck it and see sort of thing. But broadly speaking, although obviously it changes year on year, broadly speaking, about 60% of novels published in the UK every year are written by women and 40% by men. And about 70-75% of novels bought are bought by women. One of the reasons we set up the prize was precisely to encourage male readers to try books by women. When we did an enormous piece of research of 2,000 people, it was pretty clear that the publishing industry, on one hand, bears some responsibility for this by treating, again, back to the idea of the neutral voice, a lot of novels by women as books for women. So putting covers on them, that you will know the covers I mean, that are either shockingly bright or they have a picture of a woman's dress, but somehow their head and feet are always missing. I've never got involved with that. So publishers essentially say, this, male readers, is not for you. Whereas with male writers, often they are ungendered covers. And indeed, when Labyrinth was coming out, the first of my trilogy, the first image, they're very strong jackets, I think, it arrived, it had a load of pink flowers outside. And the first thing I said is, we are losing the flowers. Because I want men and women who would like my sort of books to read my sort of books. So there is an element of that. Can't blame publishers, because women are predominantly the buyers. What is curious, and why, which is why we set up the prize, is that within the academy, if you will, in universities, traditionally, the canon has been a very white and male canon. And it is changing, because, back to this theme of Martineau, people speak out and say, isn't this odd? But it's taking a long time to change. And therefore, when we were setting up the prize, looking at the figures in 1991, and it had been inspired by an all-male Booker shortlist, and that's fine, because the judges have the right to choose the books that they most admire. What was worrying was the fact that nobody noticed it was an all-male list. It was just seen as neutral. And we did the flip test, if you like, which is we just tried to imagine what the reaction would have been, journalistic reaction, if they'd been put out an all-female shortlist. It would have been the story. So out of that, we started to research and discovered that, despite those figures I gave before, fewer than 9% of novels shortlisted for major literary prizes were by women. So there was an extraordinary disparity in what was published and what was honoured. And that's why we set up the prize, and why I think we do still need it. Not because it's about different types of writing or reading, because I don't believe that women and men write differently. I think that each writer is his or herself, and I think each writer chooses his or her subject matter. Books by men that are domestic, Jonathan Franzen's Corrections, are seen as literature, whereas a lot of work by women that is seen as more domestic is just not considered for public consumption. And so I think until we get to a sense that a writer is a writer, and that men and women will choose books that they like equally, we still have some way to go. And the final thing about the research that you might find interesting was that we did discover that women chose books by women and men. Very, very few women read only women, whereas an awful lot of men only read books by men. So if you then think of who's spending the money, immediately you see the disparity in the selling. But things like the prize, many, many campaigns, the fact that it is now a live debate, the fact that at a wonderful arts festival in May in Norwich has got a lecture dedicated each year going forward to Harriet Martineau, all of these things which are about visibility and simply saying to audiences, think about this, have you noticed? And I think little by little, change happens. But as you've now all realised, I'm hideously optimistic, always.
More questions? Yes, please.
I have a question about genre and writing in general. You talked about bloggers finding the gap in knowledge or in history and slipping in and illuminating that world. And I'm interested to hear what you have to say about how far a non-fiction writer can play with fact or vice versa before it slips over into fiction, your historical
writers. Thank you.
So the question is about how much a non-fiction writer can play with the facts before it becomes fiction, and vice versa.
Thank you. That's a really good question, because it's a very live discussion in historical writing for fiction. My view is that if you want to write a novel, write it. And if you are writing the biography of somebody, don't make stuff up. Having said that, I think that there are ways of leaping the gap which are easy for historical fiction writers to do, but harder for historians or biographers to do. And I would recommend reading the works of Hermione Lee or Claire Tomlin as absolutely the top of the tree of that. There is a wonderful biography by Claire Tomlin about Thomas Hardy called A Time-Torn Man. and there are these 11 missing days. And she does it exquisitely. And she, when he was married, and he says, we might imagine that he might well have gone in a carriage such as this, but she is honest, completely honest. And I think if you're writing a biography, particularly, where there might well be either a difference of opinion or one set of correspondence is missing, so you've only got one set of letters going out, not coming in, there are ways, provided you are clear, that you do not know. But if you are writing history and biography or science, and you are not clear about that, I think that's problematic. Personally, that's a stupid thing to say, as I am the one speaking. With historical fiction, I feel quite austere about that too, in that I don't think it's justifiable to move historical events or make stuff up. So I had a lovely friend, who I will not name, who said, oh my God, you know, I'm writing this story and it's completely fantastic. I've got this all sorted out and I've just discovered about the Siege of Munster and I'm going to write a brilliant scene. And then he was downcast because he realised the dates were wrong. He said, do you know what, actually, I'm just going to move the dates. And I think, well, you don't move the dates of the Siege of Munster. You either create an imagined environment where there is a story inspired by the Siege of Munster, or you stick to the facts. So I think the other area that is very interesting in this, and of course, speaking in Norwich with the extraordinary Norwich Writers' Centre and like, you know, creative writing, is there is absolutely this new subgenre, which is life writing. Now, that is slightly different, because if it's your life, who's to say whether you're writing a novel or a biographical, fictionalized version of accounts? And I think that is very interesting. And I think that that is a different type of genre, because your responsibility is to yourself as the writer and to your readers as your readers. If you are a historian, your responsibility is to the truth. That's, again, a rather old-fashioned way of looking at it, but I think that's the difference. Because in the end, you're writing about people who lived and died, and they are true, and their lives are not your lives. Whereas when it's your own life, actually, anything is fair game. And I think we will see more of that, actually, books that are very blurred, fictionalised biographies written by the person concerned.
Any more? Yes, please.
I was just wondering about your views on the portrayal of women in media at the moment. Obviously, there's the campaign going on page three, and how things like page three and the way that women are portrayed has a direct effect on female authors and artists.
Thank you.
So that's about the portrayal of women in the media and page three.
Sorry, now I'm caught with this. Having been up since three, this is, wine is insanely strong. Dilute it down. I think it's very significant, very important, that it's back to the idea that I've been talking about plurality of voices and honouring everything that women do, not simply one tiny part of female existence. And as I said, I feel the same about male existence that doesn't get covered as much. So organisations like Women in Media and Women in Journalism have done research, which I don't have to my fingertips, but there is all very available online, which is really shocking, that a woman to be on the front page of a broadsheet will be dead, or an actress and partially clothed, or someone who is connected to it, some sort of tragedy. They won't be a lawyer, they won't be a doctor, they're very unlikely to be a woman who is an author or an architect or whatever. There's a lot of research about the ideas that if you continually put images that this is what you should aspire to as a young person, you know, wearing a bikini, that is the ultimate achievement you might have, that obviously all the rest of us who don't, and I include the men in this, who don't want to wear bikinis as a way of making a living, are somehow not following a path that looks to be ironically acceptable. It's why, again, it's coming back to the same thing, that I think it's important that we excavate all the people who do things and talk about them very loudly. So I absolutely support those campaigns, but I also think there is a great value in the campaigns which say, speak more loudly than them by putting every single day an amazing woman scientist, an amazing woman astronaut, you know, all of these things. My daughter is a feminist performance artist. And did an event, a TED talk very recently with Laura Bates from Everyday Sexism. And that was really wonderful to see this new dynamic debate going on. And I think it matters. But it's back to the question that you asked me about why do these things happen. One of the first books I published was a book by Claire Short called... what was it called?
Dear Claire.
Was it called Dear Claire? About the No More Page 3. Yeah. Thank you. I published that, it's great, isn't it? Three sips of wine, utterly incapable. And that was in 1984 or 5, and it was very much when she was having her campaign. The language and the discussion and the vilification of her and anybody who supported her would not happen now. It might happen in private, but the debate has moved on. Lots of normal men and women who would never engage with Page 3 now are aware that there is a campaign to get rid of it and are thinking, gee, that's right, do I want to stand in a sweet shop with pictures of semi-naked women up there? No. That campaign was seen as a hardcore, aggressive feminist campaign 25 years ago. And why was it? Because the media was protecting its own interests. It's back to that same thing. It's not a question of whether it's right or wrong. It was a protection of interests. The minute people start to see that this is just an issue of who's making money from whom, then the debate starts to change and it widens out. And I think that's very important. I also think, though, that there is a wonderful, joyous, rather daft parallel, if you like, that one of the most amazing campaigns at the moment, although it's very dangerous for these young women, is the young women in Iran who are taking pictures of themselves and posting themselves stripping off their veils. And again, I think it's everything can be turned to a force for good. So the internet, which is often so responsible for these images of women being driven underground and persisting, that we would all, I would imagine, in this room decry, in another part of the world is being used as a tool for liberation. So for me, it's banging the same drum, a plurality of voices, seeing the 360-degree picture, knowing what we want and what we think is right and campaigning against what we think isn't right. Positive voices celebrating the best work very well as those vilifying the worst.
Any more? Yes, please.
Yeah, I think the internet on the subject that we're discussing to some extent has actually increased the amount of misogyny, as with the situation with Professor Mary Bin recently, and she was horrendously trolled for just having given her opinion about something. I think it started with her views on Question Time, and she did actually answer back, which was quite a good thing, I think, to sort of bring that to the forefront as well.
Yes, and Caroline and Stella.
Sorry, and I wanted to make a couple of other points. A statement, really. We are also in Icene country with Boudica. So
that's why I mentioned
a lady with a sword sort of thing, which is good. But also the other thing about Harriet Martineau writing children's stories. Now, I honestly don't know anything about what she wrote, but I would hope that some of her many ideas, political, economic, social justice, you know, this sort of thing, may well have come through with some very strong female characters for children, because that's basically where it starts. And therefore, as a sort of an add-on to that, I would like to just wonder whether you would ever think about writing children's stories, because they can be really influential at a time when, you know, children's minds are developing, and sort of, it can be, you know, a real sort of spark for sort of somebody, you know, that sort of very tender age, basically. So I think it's quite an important aspect of any writers. You know, there's a lot of people do sort of mix and match, if you like, you know, with their writing.
So, 2 points, really. The internet has increased misogyny.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and will Kate start writing children's books?
Well, I just thought she might think about it.
The second part first. No, it's not my skill. You know, I think what's so interesting about Martineau and many other writers is that you do. I do believe that the vehicle chooses you. So I write non-fiction, and I write novels, and I write plays. I've not written any of the screenplays for my own books. I'm not interested in writing a biography. And oddly, I'm not interested in writing history, because they are not my skills as a writer. And I think children's books are incredibly important and influential, but I just don't have that cadence in my skill set, if you like. As for the internet and misogyny, hard to say, isn't it? It's certainly, some of it is just so extraordinarily vile that it's distressing for everybody. Obviously worse than that. Was it there all along? It's hard to say. We hear about Harriet Martineau being vilified for things she was saying. Any of you who know your suffragette and suffragist history will know the things that were done to the suffragettes and suffragists when they were arrested were done to them by men and women in the streets. So it's the sense of the tools can sometimes make things more widespread, no doubt about it. And not just Mary, but obviously Stella, Creasy and Caroline as well, and many, many other people. Joanne Harris, any of you who do tweet will know that Joanne Harris is wonderfully robust. So we'll say things like, right, you're a complete idiot, I'm turning you off now, you know. And and there are certain people who have that appetite. I certainly do fear about the proliferation of horrible views of women and men and disabled people and races, you know, the internet being used as a force to disseminate much more easily and widely terrible views. But I also think that, as with everything, when there were first cars, everybody's got in their car and poodled about the place because there weren't very many cars. And then suddenly there were loads of cars and people were dying and crashing into each other. And we realised that we needed a proper system of roads and transport and traffic lights and rules of the roads and driving tests in order to make the cars that had seemed so wonderful and had suddenly turned out to be so deathly work properly. And as a sort of metaphor, I think that's not a bad idea. I think the problem is that there is a lack of regulation and a lack of courage to address that head on, because the demon of free speech raises its head immediately. Whereas actually sometimes free speech is not as important as the regulation.
It's also the anonymity.
Yeah, and the anonymity and those things. And I think that things take a while to find, to settle out. And things are changing. You know, if you had said to me when I published the Clare short book that by the time my daughter and son were grown up, this would be something that was talked about in a widespread way, that there would be campaigns, there would be getting these magazines out of, I would have said, I don't think these things are going to change in my lifetime. So it's one step forward and two steps back. But it's that legacy of people. You know, if Martineau thought she only did things she thought she'd win at, she wouldn't have done a lot of it. And would things have changed? No. So there are many, many people in that tradition, and all of us. Because I think the very important thing when we're honouring someone like Martineau is to remember this very important truth, that each of us can do something little. And if every person does one thing, things change. And I'm often asked this by young women in schools, and they say, but it's really difficult when all the boys are making rape jokes and, you know, it's really hard to stand up. I said, I know it is. It's really horrible to say, do you know what, I don't think that's funny. But if none of you say that, then nobody knows that actually this is really offensive. And it takes one person to say it, and then somebody else goes, actually, I feel a bit uncomfortable with this. So the small steps matter too, not only the big campaigning voices, because I think that the groundswell also changes things in the way that sometimes leaders can change things.
I'm going to stop it there because Kate's got to be up at 3 o'clock again tomorrow to write the next bit of the leader's book. Do you want to give us a tiny taste of what it's about?
This is going to sound ludicrous after we've been talking about these things, except it's also the same tiny truth, possibly we're less consequent than women in the Second World War or anti-slavery campaigns or the genocide of the Cathars. The new novel is one of my Gothic novels, so in the tradition of The Winter Ghost and The Mistletoe Bride, because they are, you can imagine having worked on Citadel for 5 years, as I did, and some of the things that I read and researched, I'm haunted by some of those voices. And so, but I really like writing. So I decided to do one of my smaller ones in between, and it's a novel that's called The Taxidermist's Daughter. It publishes in September, and it came out of two inspirations. One is when I was growing up, my parents took us to a museum in Arundel in Sussex. I come from Sussex, born and bred, and it was Walter Potter's Museum of Taxidermy. And some of you might have seen pictures in the House of Curiosities, and it was in Bramble where he grew up, and then it came to Arundel, and then it went down to Jamaica Inn, oddly, for a period of time. And then it was sold off. And Damien Hirst bought a lot of it, I'm told, and Peter Blake, I'm told, bought the rest of it. And it was lots of little stuffed animals and birds. I know this sounds very ghoulish. In tableau. So the rat's drinking den, and the kitten's wedding, and the life and death of Cock Robin. And I know this sounds appalling, but I was absolutely obsessed with this museum. And of course, we forget now that taxidermy in the Victorian period was utterly about science. It was about understanding how animals and birds and we worked. Without taxidermy, Darwin and Martineau could not have done their things. It became ghoulish and it fell out of fashion because things do. It's now bizarrely very hip again and right back in fashion. But the second thing I discovered, just a tiny little thing, this had always stayed in my mind that I wanted to write about taxidermy. But the second thing was to discover that although women were mostly the people in Victorian England and even into Edwardian England, the people who laid out the dead, they couldn't be taxidermists. It wasn't a job that women did. And so, of course, as a novelist, out of that comes the idea of, aha, I'm going to have a taxidermist who's a woman, but it's all secret. But truthfully, it's Mill on the Floss meets Psycho. if I'm absolutely honest. And I am at that stage where I'm sitting sort of typing every morning going, oh my God, how many people are dead? Are they dead? Have I killed them yet? Is the bird skinned? What's going on? And, you know, that is again part of a writer's life, as I was saying this evening, is that we do different things. We do different things. We tell the stories we want to tell. If I did ever feel that a children's story came to me, madam, I will remember you, and I think there it was, 25 years ago, that question came up, and it wasn't for me. So I'm having great fun writing it, but those of you who know a lot about publishing will know that for a book that is publishing on the 11th of September, it would be awfully good if it was finished. So I will return home to Sussex and finish it.
Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A wonderful evening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For listening to this podcast by Writers' Centre Norwich. You can find out more about the centre at writerscentrenorwich.org.uk.